All right, so good morning, everybody. We're going around the room and giving introductions, so I'll give mine. My name is Paul Friels. I work for Red Hat. I used to be the Fedora project leader from beginning of 2008 to the summer of 2010, so about 2.5 years I did that. I was a contributor to the Fedora project for roughly 4.5 or 5 years before that, mainly to documentation, but I've done a lot of other things as well, websites, design, helping coordinate with translators, marketing. I've been an ambassador, so I've gone to, trade shows, things like that. Red Hat actually offered me a really cool role, which is what I'm doing right now. I'm an engineering manager there in the department that builds Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which of course is our flagship product and the one that makes a lot of our money, and I'm doing coordination duties for our next release of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. So I also used to teach a lot in previous lives, not just on the road and at shows representing Red Hat and going to Linux community shows, but I used to teach a little bit professionally as well. One of my previous lives. So I'm going to talk to you here about Linux file systems. This is going to be a fairly quick-paced presentation, but I'm going to cover a lot of topics. I'm going to talk to you about your storage devices, how storage is organized on your system. Then we're going to cut all the way from that down to the file system level, and some of the utilities that you can use to actually do useful things with your files. And the point behind this is I want to give you a grounding in how you can organize storage on your system. Now, I'm going to be concentrating on the home use case. Why? Well, because there's a lot more equipment and a lot more possibilities involved when we're talking about like professional level storage. But the concepts that you learn here will scale to large systems as well. All right, the kind of things I'm not going to cover are things like storage clustering. I'm not going to go heavily into depth into things like InfiniBand and Fibre Channel over Ethernet and some of the latest technologies that are being used for large scale storage. Although Linux does handle those kind of storage very, very well, and that's why it's so pervasive now in the enterprise. Linux is actually the fastest growing server operating system out there. So no matter what you hear about who has market share now, although Linux has a very, very sizable portion, Linux is actually growing at a faster rate than other operating systems, including Windows. If you think about the implications of that, you can see that it's kind of eating into Microsoft share out there, which if you're a lover of free software as I am, that should feel pretty good. We may not have made the deep inroads into the desktop that, say Apple has in recent years, but we're kind of holding our own there at sort of the 1 or 2% level. But it's in the server level, Linux is a definite power player in the industry. So keep that in mind as we go forward here. All right, so I'm going to talk first about disks and partitions, and then we're going to cover a little bit about logical volume management, which is a way about more flexibly using the storage pieces that you have. And then we're going to talk a bit about file system formats. And depending on the questions and interests that people have, we can go into a few internals about some of the native Linux file systems, if anyone would care to. And again, I'm going to concentrate on practical use by people as a home or a desktop user. So what this means to you. So the first thing I'm going to cover here is again, disks and partitions. So what kind of disks do we see in most home use cases? Well, so in the old days, we had disks that were called IDE or SCSI, right? These are different interface types that you would hook up to your home desktop or your laptop. And SCSI actually is still around, although it's not as popular as it used to be, simply because there are newer and more flexible and much faster mechanisms out there, bus types for connecting disks. The most common disk that you're going to find in low-cost commodity systems, that is the kind that you'd find, at home, you get from Dell or HP or whoever, are going to be SATA or serial ATA. That's the connection type that most laptops and home systems are going to have. Yeah, so Peter made a good, thanks, Peter. Peter Larson made a good point, which is that on the server side, kind of in the, I guess, kind of low to mid-grade server line, you're not going to find SCSI as much. Nowadays, it's more PATA, right, parallel ATA. And that offers a wider bus, some faster connection speeds.
Do you mind if you ask a question now?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, I'll take questions now. That's fine. Just shout out. And I'll try and repeat them for the podcast here as well. Yep. This is a great question. It's actually all of the above. So the question was about, you know, what are the differences between these buses, between IDE, SCSI, SATA? Is it just the fact that the cable is different? Is the controller different? It's actually all of the above. So it's not just your controller is different, but your controller actually then is hooked to one or more different kinds of physical medium, like a ribbon cable that has a certain number of pins, and that the number of pins may be different, right? The standard for SCSI offers several different options for how many pins are connected and how wide that cable is. And then there's also a transport mechanism over that cable. So there's a signaling standard as well. And that's used actually to enforce the communication between the controller and the devices that are hooked on that bus. Right, so it's actually all of the above. SATA is really useful because it uses a much smaller, tighter cable. It's less expensive. It also, because it's not a big ribbon, it's a smaller cable. So it actually allows better airflow in your devices. And of course, on a laptop, that's super important because those devices are getting smaller and thinner all the time. And so airflow is incredibly important when you get to those really tight form factors. Yeah, so Peter made another good point, which is that when you're choosing equipment, depending on the grade of equipment that you're choosing, also the type of application that you're going to be hosting on that server, the number of people that you're going to be hosting, the bandwidth that you need, all of that stuff is going to figure into your choice of a bus type on where you're going to concentrate your storage. And so that's why, you know, up here you'll see that, you know, I talk about laptops and home desktops, but I also mentioned some of these other much higher bandwidth and also, not coincidentally, much more expensive options like Fiber Channel and InfiniBand. There's Fiber Channel over Ethernet now, and that storage is going to get incredibly fast because now that Ethernet is moving from, you know, we've gone from 10 megabit originally to 100 megabit to 1 gigabit, which you find on pretty much everything nowadays, comes for free on your laptop and on your desktop. And now they're moving to 10 gigabit, 40 gigabit, and I hear that 200 and 500 gigabit Ethernet are on the way. So that is all, that all means that the storage, if you're moving your storage transport over those incredibly fast network links, you know, you're taking advantage of that as well. And they're also, and of course, with that come all sorts of flexible routing options and everything else. So that could be an entire course in itself, how you would build those types of storage arrays. Yeah, there are people out there that all they do is build storage arrays. And that's, I mean, it's an incredibly nuanced and interesting and highly skilled area that you can get into. So, on the other hand, we're concentrating on the real easy stuff, which is like your laptop or your home system, which probably only has one hard disk in it, especially with the sizes that we have nowadays. Usually only find one in a laptop, of course, but also even in desktops, the storage is so large, most of them only have one disk. And when you have a disk in your system, all devices on Linux can be found enumerated under the /dev directory. And we'll talk about directories and folders later on, but I'm going to assume just a little bit of user knowledge that you've at least come in contact with using files and folders. Even if it was in a graphical environment, that's fine. But in your dev directory, you're going to find a lot of device nodes enumerated there. And each of those files is a special kind of file that actually represents a hardware device. And it's a way that you can actually communicate at a low raw level with a device. That does mean that if you are doing it improperly, and if you are doing it as the device administrator who rules the system, you can do some damage if you're not careful. So you do have to be careful about referencing these devices. But a good thing to note is that the hard drive storage in your machine, whether it's IDE, SCSI, or SATA, generally is going to come in as dev SDA. Now, it used to not be the case, but quite a number of years ago, the device nodes for these disks were all sort of funneled down into the SD type device nodes. So SDA is going to be the first one, SDB would be the second one, and so on and so forth.
Basically, you want to discuss it, which is the part of this.
Yeah.
So you used to have, Scottsdale has a very...
So we're going to, so I know we want to like explain every detail of this stuff for people, but since we've got the podcast in a limited amount of time, I'm going to try and keep us, we'll try and keep to the goodies here. All right. So anyway, that's your device now. Just something to keep in mind is DevSDA. All right. So there are other ways of hooking up disks together, right? You're not limited to just one disk. If you would install a second hard disk in your system, it would come in as DevSDB. You can actually hook a number of disks together and put together what we call a RAID, which is a redundant array of inexpensive disks. And this is a concept and a practice that have been around for a very long time. There used to be special controllers that you would have to buy in order to build a RAID. And you'll sometimes hear people say RAID array, even though that's kind of redundant itself, but I'll even say it sometimes. But to build a RAID, you would buy a special kind of controller. And usually the only way you could do it is with SCSI in the old days. But what's really cool is that Linux, years and years ago, developed the ability to build software RAID. So that your CPUs got fast so quickly, thanks to, you know, Moore's Law and kind of riding that curve, that the CPU controller could be an effective way of managing a RAID system. And because of the very uniform and reasonable and logical way that Linux accesses devices, not just disk drives, but including disk drives, it became very easy to build the code that would treat any device as a member of a RAID. So you could build a RAID out of cheap IDE disks back when SCSI was much more expensive. And that was great because if you were a hobbyist or something, you could really build some cool storage and develop that kind of code without having to spend oodles of money on high-end SCSI controllers and high-end SCSI disks. And nowadays, the same thing is possible with just plain old SATA disks as well. So with a RAID, you basically combine two or more disks into a group, and that group of disks are managed together, right? And there are different ways of building a RAID. I'm not going to go into all the details because you can look them up at Wikipedia. If you go to Wikipedia and look up RAID, there's great explanations of how RAID works. But essentially, when you build a RAID, all you are doing is you are trading off some storage capacity for fault tolerance. The more storage capacity you trade, the better fault tolerance you can get, right? But it's completely up to you. You can actually, there are ways to build a RAID that actually have almost no fault tolerance or zero fault tolerance. You can use them to lay disks end to end and turn it into one big disk. The problem is one of those, what you've done in that case is you're actually decreasing the fault tolerance over a single disk because you have multiplied the chances of a disk going bad and you've added no ability to tolerate that kind of fault. But it is possible to lay disks end to end to do that in what they call a linear or a linear system. Or you can go all the way up to levels like RAID 5, RAID 10, RAID 15 or 16, and actually you can build arrays that will carve off specific disks or areas on specific disks in order to build fault tolerance areas. So if one device goes bad while the array is running, you literally can pull that disk out if your hardware allows it and connect a new disk. The new disk will be automatically re-imbued magically with the data that was on it before by using some of the information that's layered on the other disks, and you're up and running. And that way your customers, the people who are seeing that RAID and using it that you don't see every day, they never know it's happening. You just take care of it in the back room. But again, so on the home system, though, chances are you're probably not going to do a whole lot with RAID. If you do want to experiment with RAID, there are particular ways you can do that don't involve having to chew up your entire drive or having to go buy a disk drive. There are all sorts of ways that you can build fake block devices out of files and experiment with how RAID works. And that's, again, this is one of the things that's so awesome about Linux is that you can abstract just about anything so that using the equipment you have available to you, you can kind of fake a lot of different setups and experiment with how they would work and use that as a learning device. So if people want to get into RAID and stuff like that, you know, we can definitely take that up on the mailing list or the forum outside the talk and talk about how to do that. So again, you can see I'm kind of like skirting these issues because we only have a limited amount of time, and RAID is just, it's an amazing topic, but it's like a whole talk on its own. So now I'm going to talk about partitions. Partitions are pretty much what they sound like. It's a way of dividing up a device, dividing up a disk. So every disk that's shipped in a computer system nowadays is going to have some partitions pre-existing on it. The sole exception would be the very few vendors out there of home systems that ship a blank disk for the user to put Linux or some other operating system on. That happens very rarely because manufacturers actually get a subsidy from Microsoft for putting Windows on it. And if they're going to put Windows on it, it means they're going to pre-partition the disk. So that's what you're going to find in just about every case. And the same goes for Apple. They have a special kind of partition map that they use, but again, that disk is still divided up into usable areas. Yeah, it's a great point. So the point was that disks are pre-partitioned like that, not to show people partitions, but to basically give them a pre-built operating system, and the user doesn't have to make any choices. They don't have to know anything about the partitions that are underlying it. And, you know, the reason we show it here is that it's interesting for you to know from a Linux perspective because it can help you sort of craft your storage in some unique ways. And I'm going to explain a little later how that can be useful to you as you develop your skill as a user. So, at the top of the disk in general, although this does change, in some cases this is at the bottom or end of the disk nowadays, but it, depending on what kind of system you're using, there will be somewhere special on the disk, a map or a table that describes the layout of the disk. And there's only a certain amount of space that's reserved for this. So if the map gets too big, in other words, if you start getting more than a certain number of partitions, there's usually a way that table can grow on the disk. And then that way you can define increasing numbers of partitions. That actually will be the case in most Linux setups, because a lot of people who are putting Linux on their system are going to do it as a dual boot system. How many people here have dual boot systems at home? Right, so most of you. Okay, so generally what that is people who are running Windows, and then they'll install Linux next to it, and you'll follow certain steps, and usually the installer that you're using will take care of shrinking down the Windows system and then installing Linux into the available space that makes, and then allowing you to boot between those operating systems whenever you like. I actually haven't done this in a while because all we have in my house at this point is Linux. My family uses it, I use it, and we don't really have any Windows. So the point that I want to make here is that, you know, these partition tables that are out there, or partition maps, will describe how the disk is laid out. In other words, on the disk from this block to this block is one partition. And the partition map will actually have a code that will tell it what type of file system it thinks is there, but they don't have to necessarily match, which is an interesting issue on its own. But most operating systems will use the label, use it correctly, but just keep in mind that the label that's there, it's not required that it match the actual file system that's on the partition. So that can, if you get into an odd state, you do want to just keep that in mind if you're trying to rescue a system or something like that. So anyway, the reason that the partition system becomes complex like that in most dual boot cases is that Linux requires three partitions in most systems, at least three. You can use more, but you require three. One of them is the boot partition, and that's where, you know, that has the information where you actually bootstrap the system. There's a kernel and usually what's called an initRD or initial RAM disk. And that name goes back a very long way. But what it really means is that it is a small file system that's preset with a bunch of utilities, a bunch of files, and a bunch of information and data that your system needs to actually get started running not just the Linux kernel, but a bunch of the other utilities and services that you need to start for your system to be more complete and useful. So that all of that stuff will live in this boot folder. And that way your system can actually start up and get to a running state. There's also a partition called swap. And you'll notice I didn't put a slash before that. It's because that's not actually the same as a file system where you would store files and directories. It's basically just this raw blob, this area of disk that your kernel, the Linux kernel, that is the core of your operating system, uses to move around data that it's no longer using actively. So if you, rather than running out of memory when you load up a certain number of applications, your kernel will take care of swapping out or paging out data that it thinks you are not actively using, because that application may not be taking much time or accessing those pages, and it'll move that data out to the disk, which is a kind of a slow operation, but it will happen. And then that way the kernel can free up some memory, so you can actually run more than your RAM normally would allow. So if you only had, say, a gigabyte of RAM, and say you had another 2 gigabytes of swap, and let's say you fill up your gig of RAM and you load a very large application that takes, say, another 300 megabytes of RAM, right? Some of that information in memory, the kernel will take care of writing it out to disk. And then once it's out on the disk, you've freed up that amount of memory in RAM. And once that's free, your kernel can then load the information that you're actually actively using or want to use off of the disk. And it will do that dynamically as you run your system. It happens all the time. There's nothing you need to worry about for that to happen. It just happens, right? Running out of memory on a Linux system is unless you are doing certain server operations that are probably unlikely if you're just getting started, chances are you are never going to run into out-of-memory errors. That does not mean that they never happen. They can happen in any operating system. Linux is no exception. But Linux is very efficient about using memory, and it's very good about letting you know if it runs out of memory. Your system doesn't immediately die either, right? The kernel will take care of shutting down or killing things to let it continue running if it can. Okay, so that was the second of three. The third partition is just slash. It's also called the root partition. Everything else can be stored there. Now, that doesn't mean that most Linux systems only use these three partitions. That's pretty rare. Usually you will find more. But these are the only three that you need. Anything not stored in boot basically can be out in this other partition. But that's not really the best way to set up a system, right? Why is everything in root? Well, let me explain a little bit about the unified file system here. In Linux, you don't have the equivalent of a Windows C drive or a D drive or, you know, those lettered things. The whole file system is unified under one slash folder, right? That slash is like a delimiter for a folder, right? So then under that you can have folders with names. If it's a folder like, say, home, then you would have slash home. And then under that folder, you could have other folders. So you could have slash home slash user one, slash home slash user two. So that slash is a way of delimiting the folder names that you can build a path. What's the equivalent for that in Windows? Any of the beginners or intermediate folks here know? What's the equivalent of the slash in Windows? Backslash, yeah? In Windows, the slash is the other way, right? And that's how their folder names are. Now, that doesn't mean you've necessarily seen them, right? Because in Windows, generally, you're not using a shell or something where you would type these characters. You generally just, you know, double-click and open a folder, and inside it's another folder, and so on and so forth. And in Linux, you can do all that, too. So don't feel like you have to work with these bits every day, because you can do that exact same stuff in a graphical interface in Linux. But behind the scenes, just like in Windows, there have to be ways for the underlying operating system to understand what part of this path is a folder name, where does the folder name stop, and then where's the next piece of the puzzle, right? And that's what that slash is for. And in Windows, it's just a backslash. So under that top-level folder, you have a bunch of folder names that come with your system, right? They're put there for a reason, because they separate out different kinds of information. For instance, under slash bin, which stands for binary, you would have a bunch of utilities that a user can run. There's also a slash sbin, which means essentially super user binaries, the things that only an administrator generally will run, or a privileged user who's escalated their privilege would be able to use those. /etc or et cetera, right? That's where you would store configuration data, things that don't make sense to store elsewhere. The kind of things that the administrator would tune in order to make the system optimized for what they're doing, right? And you're an administrator, right? If you own a system, I'm talking about the administrator, I'm talking about you as the owner. And I'm going to talk about administrators versus normal users, but in your house, that might be you as the Linux guru versus, you know, your kid as a user on your system, right, who's sharing that same desktop computer. So all these folders basically live under the root. And how you break up the file systems under this is, well, up to some extent, it's up to you. There's a level at which you do not break these things up. Like, you don't break up bin from Etsy. Right, you don't make special areas for bin, you don't make special areas for sbin. There are a lot of things that have to live together, but there are certain pieces of the system that it might make sense to break up. So let's look at why you might do that. So the question was, when Mark does an install of Ubuntu, you know, he'll build a swap partition, he'll have a boot partition, he'll have a root, and then he'll have a home. And then what happens when it asks him where to write the master boot record? The master boot record is actually not a, it's not a file per se. It's a wad of information that your system uses to bootstrap itself when you turn the power on after the self-test happens. And, you know, it tests your memory and your hardware and, you know, the drives go and they spin up. And then your system actually starts to load the operating system. That master boot record is just a very small bit of code that only does a couple things. It tells your system how to read the partitions, the partition map, and it tells it where to find the next bit of code that it needs to load the operating system. So the master boot record is not really a file that you as a user or even as an administrator would touch day to day. It's actually just a bit of code that lives at the very beginning of your disk and tells it how to get to the point where it can actually load the operating system, the rest of the bootloader that it needs. Okay? So that doesn't actually live in /boot. Oh, they don't require /boot anymore?
No,
oh, okay, so I'm out of date. Right. I'm thinking back in those days, yeah. And your boot was always early, yeah. So there are some wrinkles to this. So yeah, slash boot is not, you're right, it's not required, especially on a single disk system like we're talking about. There are special places that that boot stuff can't live. For example, if you build a RAID or if you build an LVM, logical volume management, you can't just put the boot files anywhere. On a single disk, you may not need to have a /boot partition, but it's a good habit to get into because when you get into more complicated setups where you have multiple disks or RAID or LVM, you can't necessarily just put the boot files in with the rest of the file system because the system won't understand how to get to the RAID. It won't understand how to read the LVM and so on and so forth. Makes life simpler to have it separate. Okay, requirement is slightly overstated, but you know, I think from the home user standpoint, I think it's a good practice to get into because as you get better, and especially if you start working with Linux at work and you start building systems professionally, you know, you don't want to have to fight why can't my system boot? Oh, it's because I didn't build a boot partition outside the RAID that the system could get to, right? So it's technically not required. Highly recommended. So this is a great question. So Chris asks, so next time I install Ubuntu, if I make a /boot, will it know what to put there? Yes, absolutely. When you do that in the installer, it knows to put the bootable files that Ubuntu needs in the boot partition. And the same with, you know, all the other distros as well. When you make a /boot partition, that label on it, boot, that's a reserved name for a folder, and your installer will know to drop the boot files into that partition because it's going to build a tree of those folders the same way that your system would when it starts. And it'll put the files that live in the boot partition. All right, so why would we want to break things up? You remember I talked earlier about how we really only needed these three, but there were ways that we could split things up or not, depending on what we wanted to build. Why would you want to break things up? Well, one reason is to guard against problems of running out of space. What do I mean by that? Well, if you have file systems living on separate partitions or separate volumes on your disk, then if one volume runs out of space, it doesn't mean that your whole system runs out of space. So let's imagine the case where we have just that one slash partition, and then everything other than the boot files, which are living in slash boot, everything else gets written to that. If we fill up that file system, if we download a whole bunch of applications, if we build a bunch of user data, if our database grows beyond all measure, or maybe something goes wild and our system logs start growing to obscene amounts, it would be possible for your system to actually run out of space to write the files that it's constantly doing behind the scenes, which are part of the system. And if it runs out of space to write those files onto the disk, your system will start acting in all sorts of weird ways. Things like you won't be able to log in suddenly, and you won't know why. I know I got my password right, why can't I log in? Or why won't my desktop environment start? Or why I've been running this system for, it's been up for 3 months. I sat down this morning and I tried to start an application, it wouldn't work. So I tried to open another one, it wouldn't work. I rebooted, the system won't reboot properly. All of these strange things can happen when your disk runs out of space to put more files. So by breaking things up, you can ensure that one type of system data filling up the disk doesn't affect the entire system. It doesn't mean that it will make it impossible for all that to happen, but it makes it less likely. Or at least you can be alerted before it happens and actually take some remedial action. Another good reason to break things up is that one of the special areas, or reserve folder names is called home. And home is a folder under which there are subdirectories where all the user's data lives. So if you have a user named Chris, a user named Mark, another user named Mark, W, each of them has a separate folder inside home where their user data is stored. If you put the home folder on its own partition, that means that you could actually reinstall your operating system without reformatting that partition and then use it again on the next system. And that way you don't touch your user's data, but you can reinstall around it. You can change your distro doing that. The point was that if you build a separate home, not only can you just reinstall, but you can actually, you can hop around distros if you like. One thing you do need to be careful of is that, as you move around distros, the versions of things change. And so, you might be running, application FUBAR 1.3 on distro A, and it's 1.2 on distro B. And so FUBAR 1.2 and 1.3 may have slightly different configuration files. And so you do have to be careful of that when you move distros like that, you might encounter some issues with that. But on the whole, that's an excellent way to try out different distros and not lose, you don't have to lose all your data just because you want to change your operating system. So it's really, really useful. Try doing that on Windows with just a C drive. The answer is you cannot. You cannot reinstall Windows doing that. So you have to blow away your data, back it all up, reinstall, restore all your data. And nowadays, with the amount of storage that people use, it's really, really hard to do that. That's why a lot of systems nowadays come pre-configured with separate partitions. Like nowadays, you'll find a lot of Windows boxes ship with a C drive and a D drive. And the reason is the user data is configured to go into the D drive. So the point that Dave made is that a lot of times the D drive is a recovery drive. It depends on the manufacturer, right? There are different ways that manufacturers do it. But actually, often what I see is that the system recovery partition will actually be hidden because they don't want the user getting on the D drive and messing up those files and then not being able to restore their system to a factory reset. But yeah, many times that drive will be available on the user. At least you'll be able to see it. Whether or not you can access it is another question. All right, so what are some reasons why you would not want to break up your system? Well, understanding partitions can be complex, especially for a beginning user. And it can get more difficult to manage them because if you run out of space, you have to look through them and figure out where you ran out of space. If you're looking to add space, you've got to figure out where you need it. That's not always as easy as it sounds, right? Because if you're looking at your system and you've got, say, many partitions set up on it because, maybe you followed some random guide on the internet and it told you to make like 12 different partitions for things, and you can't download anything, and you say, well, I don't get it. I have a 640 gigabyte drive. I just installed the system 3 months ago. It can't be full. And the answer is, of course, it's not, but some of that space may be where you don't expect it to be, or it may be used in a place that you really can't download things into. You know, it's going to cause you some problems. So that there is that complexity issue. So hopefully this, you know, this talk will give you a couple of the tools that you need for understanding what's on your disk. Okay, so what I'm going to do here is we're going to actually, if I can make this work, we're going to run the disks utility here. Now I'm just using this GNOME utility called disks. There is a name for this utility. It's called palimpsest, and I have no idea why, and I have no idea how any of you would know to remember that. So the good way to remember it is that if you're running a GNOME type operating system, you would just look up the disks tool. If you're running something other than GNOME, your environment probably has a tool very much like this. I think there is a KDE. Counterpart to this utility. I even think that I believe that LXDE and XFCE also have counterparts to this. Yeah, and that's a good thing to remember, that no matter what environment you have, typically you can run other environments' tools. You just have to have the toolkit installed for that to work. And of course, your distro takes care of managing all that. So you should be able to find this in your distro of choice. Now, the nice thing is this has actually got a nice little layout for my disk. This shows me that I've got a 320 gig hard disk installed. And there's a bunch of stuff here we're going to talk about later about how it's partitioned up. But you know, I just wanted to show you that I can see what's available on my hard disk. And you know, there's a nice little tool thing where I could do, oh God, don't do that, don't format the disk. But I could do things like view the smart data, which shows me how well my disk is working. Looks like everything's cool. I like that. All right, let me show you. I'm going to open up this terminal, and let's make it a little bigger. Can everybody see that okay? Okay. All right. So what I'm going to show you is a neat little utility called df. And df is a command line utility that tells you disk free. It tells you how much free space you have. Now, when I run this, actually, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to shrink it down one little bit. Okay. Actually, you know what? That was a little hard to read. I'm going to add the -h to make it human readable. There we go. And now you can see the number of file systems that I happen to have on my system. I've got quite a few of them. Don't worry about the long and confusing names. You don't see much of the SDA there. You do see one, right? Which file system is mounted that's just a partition for my disk on dev SDA? Can anybody guess? Right? Boot. If you look for dev SDA1, it's about halfway down the listing there. That's just a plain old disk partition, and it's mounted at boot. Remember I told you that that's like it's a plain old partition. Makes it easy for your system to find it if you're doing complicated things like RAID or LVM. And I do use LVM, so that boot lives outside it. It's just a plain old partition, /boot. But if you look here, you can see where I have different bits of space allocated. The root file system, or that slash, I've got about 12 or 13 gigs, and it looks like I've used about 7.7. That's because all my applications basically live there. All of the programs that make the desktop environment work, the programs that run behind the scenes and, you know, make the disks work, the things that, you know, allow all the services that I'm running, all those applications are stored in here. Right, and that's why so much space is used. If you look at, let's see, and also you will see that again here. This is actually the same, this here is the same as this. The system refers to it as two different things as an abstraction, but these are actually the same file system it's referring to. Okay, and don't feel like you need to take careful notes on this because it will turn out different on your system probably. I have a temp file system, which is actually part of RAM. It looks like I've got about 4 gigs of that. I have some different partitions. I've got one mounted at var. I've got a subdirectory of that that's on a separate file system, which is, what do you think I store here? Anybody want to guess? Yeah. You could guess, Oracle, but you would be wrong, sir. Wrong, very wrong. Yeah, I'm actually, that's where the storage location is. I think I'm actually running Maria on here, but But yeah, so that's where my database data is stored. I don't even know why I used like 4 gigs for that, because I don't come anywhere close to using it, but whatever. And then I've got an area for vert images. That's where I store disk images for virtual machines. I've got a bunch of different partitions. And look, here's my separate one here for home. And look how much space I have for that. That's pretty much the majority of the disk. So I leave most of it for the home folder. Why? Because that's where you're going to store the most stuff. As a normal user, you're going to have download things, you're going to play with data, you're going to make documents, you're going to make all sorts of things of your own. Generally, that's where you want to allocate most of your space, is to the user data, because that's what's going to change day to day the most. That's where you're going to download things and do the stuff that you do every day. I actually have a separate temp. I don't know if this is really necessary, nor is it recommended anymore these days. I'm not sure. So the way that I've always built systems is I've always made a separate /TMP. TMP is a temp, just like it sounds, temporary, is a special folder that a lot of applications on your system use, not just the ones that you're running, but things that the system is running behind the scenes, to store temporary files. Basically exactly what it sounds like. It's a place where the system will build files and create and destroy things all the time, right? It's also a place sometimes where systems will build temporary log information, even though maybe not be the right place for that to go, but sometimes they do it anyway. A lot of applications use that space. Why would you make it separate? Well, if I have a program that I'm running that is making very large temporary files, I don't want the growth of those temporary files to inhibit my system running, right? If I fill up temp, there are easy ways to destroy that data and get the system back on its feet very quickly. If temp is part of, you know, a larger file system, it may be harder for me to identify where that space is being used and get rid of those errant files. So there are things that will fill up your temp file system, badly behaved applications or applications that are misbehaving or malfunctioning, that can fill up the temp area. And if you don't have a separate temp partition, it can affect your system badly. If you have a separate temp partition, your system actually can keep running fairly well, and you can simply clear the temp out and keep going. So I find it very useful to make that separate. What I would also say is that your distribution probably has documentation out there from system experts who will tell you what they recommend doing in terms of building file systems, like how many partitions should I make? Which one should be separate? How do I know? A lot of system vendors will give you that in their documentation. So in the Fedora world, you know, I only speak this because this is the one I know, because I wrote most of it. There is a document in our installation guide that gives you some hints on which file systems, like how many file systems you might want to build and where you want to mount them. Like you would want to make a separate slash, a separate var, a separate home, and a separate temp. So there's a good, yeah, that's great. And that there's a good example. So what Peter was pointing out is that df-h, which means disk free, and then -h means human readable, which means rather than give me big numbers of blocks, tell me in gigs or megs or whatever. So what I've done is using a directory name after that, or a location, a path, the system will determine which mounted volume or partition is being used to store the data at that location, and then it tells you how much space is left there. So if I do dot, that means current directory. That's the same as in Windows, by the way. And I could have just as easily said df-h/home, and it would tell me, okay, which file system stores the stuff that's in /home, and then it would tell me how much space is left there. So you don't have to look through the big listing. That tells me that I've got 104 gigs used out of 147, about 71%. Cool. I got plenty of space. That's good. If I do the same thing in temp, let's say weird things started happening on my system. I wonder if I'm running out of space somewhere. Maybe it's temp. Hey, I found this really huge file in temp. So if I do a df-h on temp, I can see how much space is used. That's 1.3 gigs out of 2 on temp is actually quite a lot. That's quite a lot of space. I don't know what's taken at all, but we'll look into that a little bit later. How's that? Does that sound good? Well, maybe we'll investigate that in a little while. Why does it mount multiple points on the same part? Okay, so when you say multiple points,
it means the different names.
Oh, okay. So there's different. In other words, you see different names, but they're mounted on the same area, right? In most, so what the what those don't actually represent different things on the disk. They represent the same thing referred to in two different ways.
Same inode.
Not an inode. No, yeah. No. We're not going to get into inodes, but no, not an inode. All it means is that this is a. For example, if we look at here's two examples: rootfs and dev mapper vgjane root. Do you see those two? Rootfs at the very top. And then if you go down about four lines. Ah, okay. That is actually, okay, those tempfs are actually different. So this tempfs, oops, hang on. Yeah, that is a good point. So this tempfs here, where's my pointer? This tempfs here, that's actually referring to a type of driver or like a file system driver. It's using a tempfs on this area. It's using a different tempfs on this area. And I think there's a couple others, right? There's a tempfs on run, and there's another tempfs on slash. Those are actually all different. Yeah. So those actually are different systems. There is a switch for the df command that eliminates those pseudo file systems. I probably should have used that, so it wouldn't be so confusing.
You have to declare these in
your fstab? No. Do you have, so the question was, do you have to declare those different tempfs's in your fstab? You do not. No, the system will take care of it for you. And it actually, when you install, it writes out an fstab. I'll talk about fstab in a little while. So let me put off the fstab itself. But you don't have to write that whole thing yourself. The system will take care of it when it installs. It's useful to look at it though later for reference and just see that what's in there, and see that not everything in there is in the fstab. And in fact, these are sometimes referred to differently as well. There's reasons for that. So we've looked a little bit at those file systems. Your installer is pretty smart. Here's the thing to remember about when you're getting started with Linux, is that your installer is pretty smart, and it figures out usually what you need as a default. And when you're getting started, it's a good idea just to let the installer do what it feels is the best reason. Because that's been designed by people who are a heck of a lot smarter than me. They knew what they were doing, and you don't have to worry about these partitions if you don't want to. And what I do suggest, though, is as you're looking at what the installer does, note the layout. And that way you can look at it later and kind of understand how what you're seeing on the running system matches up with what the installer did. It'll help you understand the system a little better going forward. So Chris made a good point, which is that in the installer, if you were trying to save your user data, the easy path choices that are made for users is not going to save your home directory. So if you need to do that, if you have user data that you're trying to maintain and you want to try and reinstall around it, use the custom choice to do that. And the same is true in Fedora. There's like several choices. Like one is, I think what they do at the very beginning is they give you a choice. Do you want to reinstall from scratch and and blow away all the data? Do you want to reinstall keeping some user data, or do you want to try and upgrade to the latest installation? So those are going to act differently depending on what you do. And Chris notes that there are problems with upgrades, and I think that's safe to say for all Linux distros that upgrading, it will sometimes work very well, often not so well. And you'll find the exact same thing is true for all operating systems, because once you start making any sort of changes at all from the beginning state of the system, it's very difficult for installers to track every single possible customization and account for them during an upgrade. Microsoft has the exact same problem that Linux has in that area. So I don't begrudge them that task, and I have sympathy for them, because it's worse because they've got 90% of the users, right? 95%. So they have to worry about a lot more people than we do, a lot more angry people who, when they upgrade, things don't work.
You can have some of ours.
So, in the Linux world, yes, things also sometimes don't work, but we tend to kind of, like, we'll tinker and fix them, right? But I think the upgrade situations generally have gotten better. Like, my last two distros, when I moved from on my big workstation at home, when I moved from Fedora 15 to 16 and 16 to 17, I actually did them as upgrades because I wanted to see how it worked. And it actually worked pretty daggone well. Admittedly, though, I don't highly customize the system after installation. I barely do anything to it, but I do it because I know that I might want to upgrade it, and so I don't change a lot of the system files or configurations, and so things tend to work pretty darn well. And I suspect the same is true with other distros, that the less you customize it, the better off you'll be. But don't let that dissuade you from customizing your system. Do get in and tinker around and stuff like that, but understand that you may not be able to upgrade as easily. The nice thing is, again, if you keep your user data separate and you make that custom choice in the installer, you can just reinstall around it. Keep your user data and be ready to go the next day. So I showed you a little bit about the disks tool. Let me tour you through it again here, because I think this is it's a really useful little tool. So we're looking at my hard disk right now. So I've got a 320 gig hard disk, and if you look at the volumes on here, you'll see how the partitions are laid out. I've got one here and another one here. That's it. I've only got two partitions on my system. But yet we saw all those things mounted. How is that possible? Where do they all come from? Well, they come from logical volume management, which we're going to go into in a few minutes. So I want to show you how interesting this tool is. I really love this tool. It actually makes disks a lot easier to understand, I think. So if you look at this disk, it tells you that star means the disk is in use and it's actually mounted. That play symbol means that it's actually running actively right now. Then we've got this other partition here, which is dev. Remember, this was dev SDA1. This is dev SDA1. And it tells us, oh, it's in use. It's mounted at boot. And look at this. It's a cute little hyperlink. And if we do that...
Did you cover what those numbers meant?
Sorry?
Did you cover what those numbers meant?
Oh, yeah. The numbers are partitions, basically, on your device. So if I... I'm going to grab... What that did... Unfortunately, you can't see it because I'm... It's a little wacky here how the presentation thing is messing with this. But so on my disk, I've got dev SDA1 here. And if I click on that /boot, it brings up the file browser and it shows me what's in /boot. These are all basically those special files I talked to you about. There's the kernels that I have installed here. I've got three of them. It's got the initial RAM file systems. It's got some configuration data. And then there's a bunch of folders that contain things that Grub, the Grand Unified Bootloader, uses to boot your system. So I think that's really useful, the fact that you can like click that and it brings up a browser. This one, though, I don't get that. Why? Well, because this is a special kind of partition. It's a Linux LVM partition. It's dev SDA2, so it's on the system knows that it's the second partition on my disk. It's quite large, taking up most of the disk. So this only takes up about 520 megs. The rest of the 320 gigs is all this one big partition. That's really weird, because what happened to, I've got all these other things over here. What do these equate to? And it turns out that these are all subdivisions of this LVM area here. And I'm going to show you more about LVM in just a second here. So we'll see how this works. And it tells me this is an LVM physical volume. What does that mean? We don't know, because you're skipping ahead, dude. Come on, show us what you're talking about. All right, logical volume management. This is one of the most useful things I think that has come around in a long time in Linux. I love it. I use it on my systems at home, especially my workhorses. So my laptop, my workstation at home. I use this all the time. LVM essentially turns storage into areas that you can flexibly adjust after installation. So in other words, if I find that I'm not using much of my database space and I need to tweak another area and up the amount of storage there, I can do that without turning my system off or anything like that. I can actually do it on the fly. This is how system administrators in a professional situation will often upgrade storage for their users. They will add some disks, add them to the LVM pool, and then extend the area so the user suddenly, without them having to lift a finger, without their knowledge even, blink, invisibly behind the scenes, suddenly they've got hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes or terabytes or whatever, more data space than they had before. Now, the one thing about LVM is you can't use it for everything. Actually, and I wrote something, actually, this is wrong. I don't even know, what was I thinking when I wrote this? I'm not sure, but you know what? I'm going to fix it right now. So there is a slight performance hit if you put your swap on LVM, just as there is a slight, very slight performance hit for all file systems on LVM, but it's like, it's fractional percent. So I was under the impression though that adds a layer over the physical partition mapping. All right, so the point that we're making here is that there may not be a performance hit on LVM as rumored, or as I remembered the news being. But even if there is, it's minuscule. I mean, it's definitely worth the flexibility, in my opinion, especially as fast as systems are nowadays. It's you shouldn't need to worry about it. Okay, but anyway, I'm going to take out that area, and that way when I post this, it'll magically be correct again. You can't really put your boot area on LVM, okay? So, and you saw that in my system. Remember, there was one partition for boot, and then it was outside the LVM area, which was the second partition.
But that has changed with Grub.
With Grub 2, you can use boot on LVM. Wow.
Whether you want to do that, I don't know.
Yeah. I haven't grown used to Grub 2. I mean, of course, I'm using it, but I haven't grown used to it yet, so I don't know what all the capabilities are. Okay, so but since there are probably a number of people who are running systems that are not Grub 2. So if you're running a non-Grub 2 system, you know, don't try to put boot in LVM, it won't work. Some installers will use LVM by default, not all of them. I think that I know Fedora does. I don't know if SUSE does. I think Ubuntu does not. They do not, okay. So LVM, I think, is a great idea because you may want to reallocate space later. And I've run into this situation a number of times where I need to add space to an area where I store like a web mirror of some information, right? Like I might store an installer tree for Fedora that's like 20-some gigs in size. And, oh, crud, my web area ran out of space. So what I'll do is I'll snip off some space from another area that I'm not using, like my home area, add it to that mirror. Then I can put more files there, and after I'm done, remove them, shrink it back down, add it back out to home. That's pretty useful, I think, right? You may not do it as a beginner, but as you get into more situations where you're trying new things, it's a really cool tool to be able to use. It's a neat tool for your toolbox. But there is a trade-off. As with all things Linux, that layer of abstraction, that layer of cool tools, that layer of flexibility, also adds a little bit of complexity that you have to keep in mind. All right, so hopefully I'm going to try and make the complexity a little simpler and try and lower it. So in order to do this, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to define for you what the building blocks of LVM devices are. You start with a physical volume. Oh, and by the way, this slide deck I'm going to post on the web, and I'll send a link out to the Fredlug mailing list, so you know you'll be able to download it and you know, show it later. It's also Creative Commons license, so you can use it yourself and remix it if you like. So anyway, back to LVM. LVM concepts. So the first building block is a physical volume. That would be an actual partition on the disk, and that was the Dev SDA 2 that you guys saw earlier, that one big block of disk other than boot on my hard disk. It's just one big physical volume that I added to LVM, to the LVM pool. Okay, and you don't have to make it a partition. You could actually add an entire disk without a partition to the LVM pool. All LVM cares about at this physical volume level is I need a big bunch of space. And it doesn't care what it lives on, but it needs to be basically a block device of some sort. And you can add that to the LVM pool. Now, a volume group is the next level up. And then when I say level up, I mean towards the user and away from the machine. The next level up is called the volume group, or VG. And a volume group consists of one or more physical volumes that you've put together under a single name, and then you manage them together. Okay? That volume group you can do all sorts of cool things with. You can add other bits of disk to it and make the volume group bigger. You can build multiple volume groups out of one physical volume. That you cannot do. But you can build like many physical volumes and have one volume group per physical volume. I find that that's not really that useful, frankly, because you might as well just use the disk at that point. But you can combine those physical volumes as you wish into volume groups. You could take a disk, and if you wanted to add half of it to one volume group and half to another, you could simply partition it first, add one partition to volume group one, the second partition to volume group two. So the comment was, I want to make sure I get this on the podcast. So the comment was, does that mean you could take two 1-terabyte disks and put them in one volume group. Absolutely. You could declare each of those as a physical, you would format each one as a physical volume for LVM, and then you would simply add both of them to the volume group, and it would treat that as a 2 terabyte volume group. Okay? And then, so here's the really cool part, then that volume group, the next level up is the logical volume. All right, and a logical volume is a portion of a volume group that's formatted with a file system, like a partition would be. So look at what we're doing. We're like basically deconstructing our disk into raw storage area, using it however we want, combining it into volume groups, and then portioning up those volume groups however we want. In other words, you can divide and subdivide your disks in all sorts of interesting ways that make sense for your user, for your users. And you might do that, especially in professional usage, you might do that to maximize bandwidth on certain storage areas and minimize it on other. Well, I don't know if you minimize it, but you might deprioritize it in one area as compared to another. You could take storage that's available on slow network links and use that for application storage, whereas you could use the network storage that's available on fast links and make that available as your data, like your backing for your data. Things like that. All sorts of cool things you can do with it. But the logical volume is the thing that you'd actually mount and then put a file system on and then store files and folders. Yeah, so that's a good point. So Mark says, in my case, I've got one big partition that is it's an LVM physical volume, and I've made it basically the only member of a volume group, and then I've subdivided that so that I can give space to one area or another area as it's needed. I can adjust. What's the advantage versus just having one big root file system, and then you don't have to worry about it because storage is there? There is an advantage in there in that if I had just one big root file, mounted that partition as one root and then, just let it go, yes, I would never have to worry about reallocating storage, but I would have to worry about the problem of one type of like malfunctioning application or overwriting data making the entire system unusable. So that's the reason that I portion it up. So that if, for example, my temp file system, which you saw had grown a little bigger than I would have expected, if it got too big, right? If something that was an errant application started writing way too much temp information, it could actually render my system unusable. Oh yeah, like that never happens, right? Jared's laughing because he knows this happens.
Last night, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So that's why. Essentially, it allows me to divide the file system up, which I could do with regular partitions, only that if I did them as regular partitions, I would never be able to adjust them after the fact. So it gives me the advantage of one layout and none of the disadvantages of the other. But yeah, I think the 2 terabyte, when you talk about the 2 1-terabyte drives, LVM makes a little more sense. The diagram that's coming up hopefully will also help make a little more sense. So anyway, but I wanted to just make sure we hit these three features: physical volume, volume group, and logical volume. And most people refer to them as PV, VG, and LV. If you could think of those as the three levels to which you build LVMs, it'll be really useful in conceptualizing it. So how do we get from one to the other? So this is a diagram where I attempt to show how the abstraction works. You start with your physical volumes on one side, right? Think of these as a bunch of disks. A volume group, when you combine those into a volume group, it allows you basically to treat them as a big bag of blocks that you can then apportion however you like. So I've deconstructed the physical volumes into the same space, but it's just kind of an assortment of space that I can then apportion. And then when I make things into logical volumes, I basically am setting up apportioning that into logical volume space that I can then format and mount. And the nice thing is I can rearrange that after the fact. So I outlined some LVM utilities here, and the main thing to note here is that there are a lot of them. So the ones that manipulate physical volumes, thankfully, all start with PV. The ones that manipulate volume groups all start with VG, and so on for LV. I think you can figure that out. There are way more utilities than I've listed here. Not all of them are going to be useful for you as a home user. Maybe none of them. You may never use these. That's fine. There's also an LVM shell utility where it allows you to script some LVM stuff. It also lets you run just one command, which is LVM. And then when you're in the shell, you can actually get, you know, like tab and get a list of all the commands that you can use. And it will actually use all of these commands inside the shell. So Jared notes that the one that we might use more than others is VG change. One point that Jared made was that VG change is one of the most useful utilities on here because it allows you to actually activate a volume group or deactivate or activate a volume group. So you can make it useful if you're adding some external storage to your LVM system. And that's totally useful because it allows you then to use that storage then flexibly, just like you would use other LVM storage. So those are some of the LVM utilities. I also just want to mention that the LVM system files, you're probably never going to look at, but it's helpful to know where they are in the Etsy LVM directory, which, you know, as you would expect, it's part of your system configuration. So there's a general config file that just describes to the LVM system how it should run. And I'll be honest, I have never tinkered with that in my life. There are things that you can do with that system. There are all sorts of options that you can adjust for, you know, how various warnings happen, what happens if the LVM system runs into an error, all sorts of priority levels that it gives for different kinds of activities. But chances are you will never need to do that as a regular user. Also interesting are the backup and archive areas. This is where the LVM system maintains backups of your volume group definitions. So for instance, on my laptop, it tells the system where the volumes, the logical volumes that I'm using, stop and start. And those do change over time when I reallocate bits of the disk. So it's a good thing that it backs them up. I would say be very careful with these files. Don't go in editing them with your favorite editor and just to see what happens, because a typo could well render your system useless. So you have to be careful with that. Thankfully, though, if you do really mess something up, there's an Etsy LVM archive, which actually stores a set of previous definitions of the volume groups, including the last changes, so that you can go back and recover if you need to. So Peter made an excellent point here, which is you will find these very, very useful if for some reason you have a horrible system failure and you need to restore from a backup, then you will want these around. And that way your restored LVM system is going to look like the original one. And that way, if you have scripts or other things that are referring to those defined names, those specific defined UUIDs, these identifiers that are on the disk, they will continue to work properly because everything will have the same appearance to the system as it had before. So these are useful. The only thing I encourage is that if you're a normal user, I wouldn't do more than look at them. I would not go in and edit them if you don't know what you're doing. Right. So Peter made another good point about lvm.conf, which is that it tells one of the only really immediately useful pieces in it for most people is that it will allow you to define what subsystems it should go search for storage. So do I have disks on USB that I should use? Which actually is a great case because I actually have that on a server at home. I've got a big USB storage drive and I want it to search that for LVM. So that's a great point. Okay, what's on your disk? LVM. Okay, so now we're going to investigate Paul's drive. What's on Paul's drive? Let's look. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to use a couple of these utilities. I'm going to run them as root, right? Because root is the only person who has access to some of these facilities. So I've logged in as the super user using sudo. First, I want to say, what physical volumes do I have on the system? Let's do a PV scan. Actually, PVS is easier to read, so I'm going to do that. Pow! And it tells me, dev SDA2. It knows by looking at the block devices on my system that one of them, dev SDA2, which is that second partition on the first hard drive, it knows that it is a logical volume. It knows that it is an LVM physical volume, a PV, and it also knows that it is a member of the VG Jane volume group. Okay. It also knows that it's formatted as LVM2, and where you see the attribute A, that means it's active or available right now. Active when it's a PV. It also tells me what the size is and how much is free on it. Now notice the free space here does not mean that's not space for writing files. It doesn't have 23 gigs of file space left. That means I have 23 and some gigs left that could be added to my volume, one or more volume groups. Minus a little bit, right? Because there's some overhead. But basically, that's space that could be apportioned somewhere, right? Including, if I want, to some of my volume groups. All right. So does everybody understand that so far, the PV? I know it's warm in here. You guys are doing a good job staying awake, I think. VGS. Okay, I'm doing a scan of my volume groups now. And I have one volume group on this box, which is VG Jane. It tells me the number of physical volumes that are part of it, which is just one. How many LVs are on this volume group? 10. I have 10 logical volumes. I can't remember what SN is. Is that serial number of some sort? I don't know what that is. Snapshots, right, duh, because I never do those. That's another thing that Peter mentioned earlier, is that LVM has cool functions that we may never use as regular users. One of them is snapshots, which is kind of a way of taking a shot of what data, like, here's your data state at this point, and then you can kind of revert over time. So some good points being made here about LVM snapshots is it's a great way to store your system state so you can revert to it later if you have to. You can do it many times. So if you look at these starting here, you can see that's my LVM, my logical volume setup. Remember how we had 10 logical volumes? You'll see them all listed here. I have blah, which is basically like a little test volume that I build. Fedora, which is a space where I store the Fedora tree if I want to do an install to another machine. Home, which is where I have all my home/home mounted. MySQL, which is where my varlib MySQL is mounted. Root, which is my actual root file system. Swap, which is my swap area, 8 gigs for that. Temp for my temp file system. I have var, which is where my logs and other stuff are stored, plus a bunch of other variable system information is there. Place where I store my vert images, I've got 40 gigs for that, and a general web storage area of 1 gig. And I haven't even used all the system at that point. So, you know, again, I've got this free space still left that I can apportion to that. All right, so we talked about LVM. Now, finally, here we are at formatted file systems. So formatted file systems, these will basically live. Now, when I talk about a formatted file system, I'm talking about the actual format that allows you as a user to organize your data using, you know, folders and files and all the things that we're used to working with day to day. All the rest of this has kind of been under the covers. So now we're talking about the stuff that's really close to you as a user. A formatted file system lives on a partition or on an LVM, LV, a logical volume. Provides an orderly hierarchical arrangement of files. So you have folders and subfolders. There are all sorts of different kinds of files you can store. I'm not going to talk about special file types or any of that stuff. We could spend a whole other class on how that works and how, you know, things like inodes work. But we're not going to get into all that here, I think, today. What you need to know for purposes of this talk is the formatted file system is what stores your file data, organization, and metadata, right? And so metadata, when I talk about metadata, it's not the actual information in the file, it's information about the file. So things like the timestamps. When was this file created? When was it modified or last touched, accessed? What are the security details? Who's allowed to do anything with it? Are there special extended attributes that mark which programs or applications are allowed to use it? How big is it, etc.? If it's a directory, how many things are in it, right? That's sort of the metadata that we're talking about. So examples of these formatted file systems, and the ones that you will run into most often right now in Linux are ext3 and ext4. There are several other types. ext3 and ext4 are the most common ones, but there are other ones like ButterFS. And of course, in Windows, the absolute most common file system you will find out there these days is NTFS and FAT. FAT is generally used for small storage devices, NTFS for most of the hard drives that are out there, whether it's a laptop or a desktop computer. And those are used by Windows, but Linux can read them all just fine. In fact, Linux reads and writes most other operating system file systems out of the box, including Windows, Mac, BSDs. Of course, Linux systems distros don't really, there's no difference between the ext3 or ext4 you find on Ubuntu or SUSE or Fedora. It's all the same stuff. They read each other's file systems. But they also read all of these other operating system file systems as well. So that's why when you take a drive that was formatted for Windows, you can, you know, a USB drive, you can stick it on your Linux box, you know, your modern Linux box, and it just comes up and you can access it, read and write to it, which is wonderful. And it was not always that way. As people have been doing Linux for a long time will tell you, was not always that easy. Nowadays, it's a snap. It's as easy as it would be on Windows or Mac. But the opposite is not necessarily true. So you can't necessarily take a Linux formatted drive, stick it on a Windows or Mac box, and have it be seen. It may not be. You may have to, in fact, download and install drivers for those Linux file systems to make Windows or Mac OS use them. Which is a shame that they're not as flexible as Linux is. But, well, what are you going to do? So the comment was that sometimes the Mac OS file systems are a little more difficult to deal with. And it definitely is true when they shift OS versions, right? Like when, whatever it was, Mountain Lion or whatever came out, they broke a whole bunch of stuff. And it's really difficult not just to install Linux, but also difficult then to make those. They also make changes to the file system formats and things, and it's all done in a proprietary way. So you're waiting for somebody to kind of figure out the format, you know, revamp the driver in Linux, and then suddenly it will start working for you in the next kernel or something. But there are some, HFS Plus utilities out there that you can get, which will allow you to read those newer HFS volumes that you find on Mac. NTFS and FAT just seem to keep working, basically. And I think a lot of the reason for that is that Windows, they have a lot harder time breaking backward compatibility. It's the cross that they bear for having 90% of the market is they have to maintain a lot of backward compatibility. Yeah. And that's good for us, right? So, yeah. It's no longer, the new technology is no longer that new. So anyway, so I talk a little bit about FAT and NTFS here, but you know, this is pretty standard stuff. I mean, this is what's used on removable media because the manufacturer can't guess your OS when you buy their stuff. So they're going to guess to the 85 or 90% case. Most likely you're using Windows. So they're going to probably provide an NTFS storage system on it. Or they'll give you a utility that will allow you to switch. In some cases, they'll write a hybrid. And because of the way that the Mac file system works versus the Windows one, it's actually possible to format a volume for both. And whichever you plug it into first is going to start writing data to the system, right? Because they figure you're going to take it home, plug it in, and they want it to work. So it is possible to do that. It can be a little tricky if you're a Linux guy, you get it. You have to figure out which you're going to use. I usually reformat my stuff with Linux file systems. So, especially using LVM like Peter described, because that's really useful. So HFS Plus and beyond, again, quick note on this, that's provided by the Apple Mac OS. The older original HFS is extremely rare nowadays, and we still support reading it in Linux, but we no longer write to it. The reason is we don't want to encourage anyone to create HFS volumes because they're going to be useless outside Linux because not even Macs read them anymore. All right, so EXT3 and EXT4, I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about these because these are the default for Linux, the standard Linux file systems. The older EXT2 is not used as much. It's a little limited in size. We've kind of grown past it, but it's basically compatible with EXT3. EXT3 adds a journaling capability, and all that means is that if your file system is in the middle of writing some stuff and the power goes out, the journal will allow you to recover the system to a known state. It does not mean that it's going to save your data and magically restore it when you bring your power back. It does mean that the file system will not be destroyed beyond usability just because the power went out in the middle of rewriting pieces of it. You don't lose anything, but you might lose a bit or all of what you were writing right at that time. EXT4 is the latest EXT type file system. It may end up being the last of the EXT series, but it supports much larger file systems, and it's typically what you're going to find in most modern Linuxes nowadays. And it has a good trade-off between scalability and performance. And you will hear a lot of people say that this performs better than that performs better than this. Always take that with a grain of salt unless you are talking to a storage expert. And if you are talking to a storage expert, they will not say ButterFS is better than EXT4. What they will say is ButterFS performs better than EXT4 in the following cases: large numbers of very small files or something like that, or very large files that have many broken extents or something like that. A good storage guy will always qualify because they know that the workload that you put on a file system makes all the difference as to whether that file system is good for you or bad for you. EXT4 is a good choice for most users who are not very demanding. And when I say not very demanding, I mean you're not running a large-scale database that's serving hundreds of thousands of connections and incidents at once. You're running one system at home. You might have at most a couple users logged in at one time, and you're probably not hitting the hard disk all day every day. So ext4 is a good trade-off. It has a good balance of performance versus scalability for most uses. So that's what you're going to find. But what about this ButterFS? I always say ButterFS because I think it's funnier. I think when it first came out, people called it BetterFS, but everyone quickly started calling it Butter. Well, everyone I know quickly started calling it ButterFS. Even and in Fedora, they had a little joke where when ButterFS was still in its very early form, there was a hidden switch that you could turn on to make the installer actually use ButterFS file systems instead of ext4 by turning on the switch that said, "I can't believe it's not ButterFS." So that was a little hidden joke. Anyway, so the ButterFS file system allows you to, it's a more modern file system design. It's more like the XFS file system that was designed by SGI originally for higher levels of scalability. And it's a performance for things like large-scale database servers where you have like high concurrency, a lot of writing that's taking place at one time. XFS is a very, very cool file system for that reason. And ButterFS, similarly, it uses some of the same design goals, although, of course, it is not infringing XFS patents or anything like that. It is its own file system. And a lot of the people who are in the kernel area really think ButterFS is getting very, very cool. So there's a chance that it may take over as the default file system. One of the things that has to happen is for ButterFS to be able to tune for the average user perspective, so that when average users are running it, they don't run into performance bottlenecks, based on what they do versus what some large-scale database admin does. But there are all sorts of tunables you can use for that. The nice thing here is that the chances are you're not going to ever have to decide which of these to use. If you do, you might be better off spending some time gardening or doing something that's a lot more fun. Most people do not need to decide things at this level. If you're a Linux hobbyist, you can pretty much take the defaults. Your distro will pick the one that's right for you. But ButterFS, it's fun to try different file systems out, definitely. But I would not be overly concerned about how can I eke out another 2%. And it's like, if you're trying to eke out another 2% of performance, but you only sit at your computer for 3 hours a day, it's probably not really worth it. So again, these performance increase and scalability increases are for the people at the edge of the spectrum, the people who are pushing the envelope. But it is a cool file system. All right, so there are some other cool file system utilities. I won't get a chance to show all of these, but I just wanted to outline some of them. DF, we saw that already, right? Shows you free space on the mounted volume. There's also disk usage, which I always find very useful, DU. Let me, I'm going to bring up our trusty terminal here. And if I do a DU, it's going to tell me how much space is being used on temp. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a couple switches to this. So I'm going to make it human readable, and I'm going to do a summary, and I want it to do everything in temp. I'm going to pipe it through, I'm going to sort in reverse based on the, oh, you know what? I can't do that with a H. So let me just do this. Star sort rn less. So this is going to go through temp, and it's going to decide how much disk is being used by various things that are on my temp area. It's going to, and it basically sorted them in reverse by the number at the beginning. So largest number first, and that tells me what are the biggest space hogs. And basically, the space hogs right now look like these enormous TIFF files of like 100 megs each, and that's from some photo processing I was doing the other day, and I must not have erased those, I guess, when I got done. And then the space after that is very, very little, so these are very, very small block sizes after that. I don't need to be worried about that. Like 12K, I don't care. That's nothing. All right, so that's an easy way to see space usage. But there are there's some cooler utilities that you can use as well. Let's do this. I'm going to call up here's the disk usage analyzer. This is a really cool tool. So if I hit that, it's going to scan the entire file system that's mounted. Everything. Every day. All the storage that's on the system, it's now zooming its way through to figure out what's being used. And this usage chart, it looks a little funky at first, but once you get used to what this means, it's really cool. So this is actually scanning through user right now, and it's figuring out how much space is used. I can drill down into the tree. Let's see if I can, bring this back a little ways here. So I don't care so much about that little chart. I just want to see these numbers. So I can see how much space is being used in the user area. What directory was I in? Share, user share. So that's 3.9 gigs. Then I can see how much of that is in each subdirectory. Look and see how much is in the lib, 804 megs. 2.2 is in the libraries. I can see what's using a lot of space. LibreOffice uses a lot of space. Eclipse. Right. This is a cool way to... I can do the same thing with temp, by the way. So here's a bunch of my temp area. You can see that this temp directory is using a lot of space. That's probably where my file, those big files were sitting. I'm going to run, essentially this looks through the entire tree that you have mounted and tells you what space is being used where. Oh, and also this usage thing here, this is a bar chart. You can't see it because I actually have quite a lot of space. Well, it's still scanning some of these areas, but a lot of these are not really using up that much area from what they're allowed to have. So there's not, you'll see a lot of these would be green or amber, but the ones that have a lot of space use where they're really running to the end of that mounted storage, that volume, they'll be red. So it allows you to quickly find the red ones and you can find where the space is that's being used. It allows you to circle in really quickly on where are the space hogs? What is using all the space on my disk? Why can't I write anything there? If the file system's full, look for the red area. And once you find the red area, there you go, look at that. So this says 100%, but it means 100% of the capacity right now. So this says out of my home area.
It doesn't compare capacity.
Yeah, it's out of the used capacity is what it is. So you're always going to see 100% here. But then out of that, where is most of it being used? Well, 88.5% of that value is in my home, right? Very little elsewhere. So I could dig down as far as I want here and see what's being used. Yeah, exactly. Well, I do actually. I have quite a lot of them. I've got like various commercials and odd videos from that I show like Big Buck Bunnies out there a bunch of times. And yeah. So anyway, so that's really useful. I think it allows you to find the space hogs. Yeah, so it was a very good point by Chris, which is that you could use that tool to find where the log file is going crazy. And then once you know that, you go in the log file and say, why is this log file going crazy? Well, let's read it. Instead of, don't just blow it away, you actually looked inside it. And then he found that this error was repeating many times, probably. Yeah. Look it up in Google. You can find the problem. Then somebody will have reported the problem, and probably somebody else has told you how to fix it. So that's, the great thing about the internet, number 45. Great things about the internet, number 45, looking up your errors. All right, so there's some other utilities I've noted here. I'm not going to run all these, but MakeFS allows you to create a file system. It allows you to create all sorts of different kinds of file systems. File system check and repair. You can check and repair a file system that's having problems. You can actually repair the problems automatically. Really, really useful. And mount and U-mount, notice not unmount, but U-mount. Mount and U-mount allow you to take a file system that's on a certain device, attach it to your system, or detach it. But I will tell you, when you're a beginning user, even as an intermediate user, even as an advanced user, I don't use mount and U-mount 10% of the time that I used to. Why? Because the systems now, the desktops are so good. I can just take my USB drive, attach it to my laptop, and it comes up. I can just browse the files on it, just like on any other OS. So yeah, Peter made another good point, which is these command line utilities, you would run them as root generally. And when you do that, you have to be careful because if you do them on, like if you create a file system on a file system that you're actually using at the time, like say the one that stores all your user data or your running app or all of your running system, you can hose yourself pretty badly. So
I would go so far as to say you should really go out of your way to go find a system you can do these and mess up a system and find out how it messes up.
So go out of your way. Yeah, exactly. Go out of your way to find a system where you can mess this up. Yeah. Yeah. So a real good idea is like one of the things that I think it's very interesting for people to try is once you have a running Linux system, of course, virtualization comes free with it. Make a virtual machine of the same system within that system, and then you can get in that. And you can mess up whatever you like without destroying your actual box. So that's really a really nice thing to be able to do.
Hard drives are cheap. Sometimes you just slap another hard drive in there.
Yeah. Yeah, or attach another hard drive and use that. All right, so what do I mean by mounts? So I spent a little time talking about mounts. Mounts are basically all your, those are your separated, your separate formatted file systems wherever they live, on a USB drive, as LVM, LVs, partitions on a disk, whatever. And when you mount them, you make them part of the single file system hierarchy, starting at slash. Everything is going to be under that. Any file system can be mounted on any directory as a mount point. The interesting thing about that is you can actually mount one file system over top of a directory that always has already has things in it. The things that were in it will appear to be covered up. They'll disappear in favor of the new file system. When you remove the file system, they'll be back. It's like you covered up one piece of paper with another. The system-defined mounts are in the etc fstab file. So here's that fstab that we talked about earlier, the fstab file. The fstab file will show you, let me go up here in cat etc/fs tab. We'll show you what file systems are going to be brought up when your system boots. Now, notice the really bizarre names that some of these have. A lot of them are referenced, especially early on, by a UUID, which is a unique, universally unique identifier, right? And that is it's a very long number that's made by a hash. A calculation, a one-way mathematical hash, and the chances that someone else ever in the history of the universe is going to come up with a disk partition that has the same UUID like that are astronomical. The chances are astronomically against it. You and I, if we compare disks, we will never find a UUID that's the same because that number is so long, mathematically speaking. All right, so that's the way the system can refer to it, even if for some reason I mount that disk as a second disk or a third disk, it's still going to have the same UUID. The metadata on that volume will be the same. So that's going to be mounted as boot. I have another. Then a lot of things appear under dev mapper. And the reason why is because everything else that I have is basically inside LVM. And the mapper, the device mapper, is a utility that goes and reads LVM and a bunch of other configuration stuff, and it turns areas on those block devices into mapped, basically the equivalent of block devices themselves. Actually, it turns them into block devices themselves. And then it manages them just like they were partitions. So they have these very long, odd names in some cases because I have them encrypted. You can encrypt volumes too. So my home area where my user data is stored, my temp area where temp data is stored, sometimes user data, both those are encrypted. My swap area is also encrypted. Why do I do that? Well, I do it because our office security policy requires it. So this is an official work, this is my work laptop that Red Hat gave me. And our security policy requires that we have a boot password. So when I boot up, I can't start my system without typing in a very, very long passphrase. And it's my own passphrase, that's fine. But everything on that system that has potential, that potentially stores company data, I have to encrypt. Where do I store company data? Well, things I download from work, things in my home area. I might end up storing stuff in temp, maybe things I don't know about, so I encrypt that as well. And I always encrypt swap because swap, pieces of memory can be swapped out there, which means potentially that's a hazard, that if you put that out there in plain text, somebody could look at your swap area and find stuff. So I encrypt those areas. What are the things I don't encrypt? Well, I don't encrypt places where I store system logs. None of my system logs are going to have company data in them. They may have an error because I did something dumb, but that's not company error. That's not company information. So I don't do that. My vert images are not encrypted. My MySQL databases are my own. I don't encrypt those. Or any of this public stuff that I store, like the Fedora tree is public source information, so I don't encrypt that either. So I only encrypt the things that are hazards for where I might store company data. So that's why the big long names. The other ones here have, notice that the other ones here have names that correspond to the volume group that partition was part of, or excuse me, that logical volume is part of, and then it has the LV name, so VGJane dash name. What you won't see mounted here is VGJane dash blah, but it does exist. Watch this. Do you see VGJane dash blah up there? So the mapper made a device name for it, but I just don't have it mounted. But I could mount it if I want. Do I have anything to mount? No. So I could do this. And I can do this because I'm rude. Oh, I may not have formatted it. Ha ha. I probably didn't, but I can make one. In fact, I wonder if I didn't make this for a similar presentation that I did like 2 years ago, and it's still there. I think it'll do EXT3 now. Oh, no, it didn't. No, it didn't do a journal, did it? So, no, EXT2. Yeah, so let's mount it, and we'll show that. Yeah, but, actually, this is good, because then now I can show what the difference would be here. And there's nothing in there but a lost and found directory, which automatically comes with the file system. And if I do mount, it tells me that's in the XT2. So now I'm going to U-mount it. And there should be a journal in here somewhere. There it is, creating journal. All right, now when I do the same thing again, XT3. Woo! And now I could put files and stuff on here now. So notice how with this mounted, I'm just going to make a quick file there. So there's that hi there file. But I can do that mount again. Hey, they're back. See? Ooh, cool. It was, wasn't it? Totally exciting. Were you on the edge of your seat? All right, so we did some mounts. All right, so that's pretty much it. That's all I had.